when we got married, my husband and I got married in 96, I bought this really pretty three-piece Mary Joseph Baby Jesus at Walmart for $9.96. And we have had that ever since.
I'm talking to Carrie from Arkansas. She's describing to me a nativity scene that she bought years ago. She has a lot of nativity scenes.
I do. I have several.
But the one she got from Walmart is her favorite, even though it's missing several of the pieces commonly found in nativity scenes.
It doesn't have animals or wise men or shepherds. It's just the big three.
But that's okay. Sometimes minimalism is what's called for. Other times, you do want to go all out. And for that, Carrie has another nativity scene.
Yes, we do have. I have one that my mom actually bought in Mexico on a vacation and brought it home as a souvenir that has all of the parts and pieces. It has the Holy Family, then it has three kings, and it also has a couple of shepherds. It had a cow, a donkey, a couple of sheep, a shepherd boy, an angel.
Aside from including Mary, Joseph, and Jesus in a manger, there's really no rules for exactly what makes a complete nativity scene. You may have a few animals or shepherds, and you may or may not have another set of characters. You've already heard Carrie refer to them by different names.
The three kings, the wise men.
If a nativity scene does include kings or wise men, and which one is it anyway, there's always three, and they tend to have a distinctive appearance.
They have their little outfits or little robes, and they're carrying the golden frankincense and myrrh.
The three kings, the wise men, the magi, the supporting cast in many a nativity scene, the subject of several postage stamps and greeting cards, the subject of that classic Christmas song. Who were they? Where were they from? Why did they traverse afar following yonder star? And what was with the gold, myrrh, and frankincense? Were they even real? And does it matter? The answers combine history, political allegiances, Greek translation, and gift giving. I'm Brian Earle. This is Christmas Past. These days, and especially here in America, the three kings are largely part of the window dressing of Christmas, the stuff of decorations and songs. They used to feature much more prominently in Christmas celebrations, though. January 6th, the Epiphany, the day that closes out the 12 days of Christmas, commemorates their visit to the baby Jesus. In fact, that day is also commonly known as Three Kings Day. Some Americans do observe Epiphany, of course, just as many others do around the world, and part of that celebration involves a special treat known as a Three Kings Cake. Yes, there's a day called Three Kings Day, and there's a Three Kings Cake, and there's a song called We Three Kings of Orientar, but if we're going to dig into all this properly, we need to start at the source. The first reference to these figures referred to them as magi or magi.
The word magi in Greek, and you'll hear it pronounced magi, magi, magi. This word in Greek is an adjective that sort of most properly translates as something like magic. It's where our word magic comes from.
That's Eric Van Den Eickel. He's an associate professor of religious studies at Ferrum College in Virginia. And that first reference is the Gospel of Matthew. It's the only one of the Gospels that mentions these figures, and it's not entirely clear what Matthew meant by magi. In his time, that word was used both positively or as an insult.
The very popular approaches to translating magi have been kings and astrologers and then wise men. When we look back at texts that Matthew and Matthew's readers would have been familiar with, other Greek texts, Latin texts from the ancient world, we see this picture emerge of magi as figures who are usually associated with a caste of Persian priests, so religious professionals of some sort, somebody who interprets dreams, somebody who leads ritual sacrifices, who knows how to do all of those things.
Well, that sounds fairly straightforward. Matthew's description is consistent with a contemporary image of some kind of religious figure. So what accounts for magi being interpreted as kings or astrologers?
And we sort of, as we move farther and farther away from a communal understanding of what magi are, who magi are, that sort of fades, and that's when they become, you know, astrologers and kings and all of those things. It's ultimately not possible to translate accurately, and also it just sort of serves as a reminder that their identity is ultimately mysterious.
Adding to the mystery is the fact that Matthew's story involving the Magi is really short. It's just the first 12 verses of chapter 2 of the Gospel of Matthew. Here's how the story starts out in the King James translation, which translated Magi as wise men.
Now, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him.
Now, right off the bat, you might have noticed that Matthew never said there were three of them, just that wise men came from the east. They said they had seen his star in the east, which is probably why some people have referred to them as astronomers or astrologers. After they arrived, King Herod sent them to Bethlehem to search for Jesus. Soon enough, they were able to spot the star in the east again and followed it to the house.
And when they were come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh.
And that's it. They arrive in Jerusalem, they go to Bethlehem, they honor Jesus, they give him some gifts, and they leave. That's the whole story.
When you go and read Matthew's story, there's just not a whole lot there. They just kind of show up. They say, we're looking for the one born king of the Judeans. And they say, so that we can honor him. But it's not really clear exactly why they want to honor him. It's not really clear any of their rationale.
Well, then, maybe we can dig in a bit to Matthew's rationale. Again, his is the only gospel that talks about the Magi. And whether the story is supposed to have any historical accuracy is kind of neither here nor there. The point is that Matthew chose to include this story in his Gospels, whereas others did not. Why?
What he's trying to emphasize and to sort of get his readers to question is this question of, you know, like political allegiance. Jesus emerges in this story as the one rightfully born king of the Judeans over and against Herod, who is the appointed king of the Judeans by the Romans. And, you know, by the time Matthew's writing, the tensions between Rome and Judea are pretty hot. I mean, they have destroyed the temple in Jerusalem by the time that Matthew's writing. And so Matthew is, I think, sending a very clear kind of political message about allegiance and about sort of, you know, about all those kinds of dynamics.
Now, we could end things here, but wait, there's myrrh. Sorry, I just couldn't resist, and I can't claim that one as my own. I got it from Professor van den Eickel. But we need to talk about those gifts. Now remember, Matthew never said that there were three magi, just that they brought three gifts. Over time, the traditional visual representation of that has become three magi bringing one gift apiece. Those gifts, of course, are frankincense, an incense from the frankincense tree, myrrh, a kind of gum resin, and gold, which you're already familiar with. Why these three gifts?
Some thinkers early on kind of concluded that these are meant to be symbolic, that they are meant to signify different facets of Jesus's identity. So the gold is supposed to be indicating that he's a royal type of figure, which is certainly something that Matthew's interested in. And then the frankincense is indicating his divinity or maybe even priesthood or something like that. And then the myrrh is, you know, kind of understood as like a burial, an ointment of some sort that would be used for burial. So sort of foreshadowing his death.
And that last point about myrrh is reflected in the lyrics for We Three Kings of Orientar. Myrrh is mine, its bitter perfume breathes a life of gathering gloom, sorrow, sighing, bleeding, dying, sealed in a stone-cold tomb. But Professor van den Eickel isn't convinced by those interpretations. As you've just heard, no evidence for those interpretations appears in Matthew's telling.
I think Matthew really imagines these things as significant because of how costly they are. And I think Matthew is trying to do everything that he can to portray Jesus as a rightful king, as a king of the Judeans.
So Professor van den Eickel thinks the answer is way simpler. Those gifts are not symbolic, they're just expensive. So I suppose we can blame the Magi in part for Christmas and expensive gifts going together. Fast forward a couple thousand years and we're still at it. I'm of that age that I remember the phone book-sized toy catalogs that arrived from Sears at the beginning of the season, serving as something of a field guide to that year's Christmas and getting us all excited about what Christmas morning had in store. Graham in Scotland also has memories of receiving a guide to Christmas at the start of the season, but of a different kind, as he shares in this Christmas memory.
Hi, I'm Graham from Johnston in Scotland. My Christmas memory. When I was a child, Christmas television was a big part of the festive season. In my region, we had three channels, BBC One, BBC Two and STV, that was Scottish television. There were no video recorders back then, so if you missed a big movie or special, that was it, unless it was repeated. That chance had come and gone. The build up to the school holidays was exciting in itself, as were the plans to make the most of all the Christmas goodies on the box. In the days before the internet, you needed a detailed plan, and no plan could be made without purchasing and meticulously examining the two TV guides. The Radio Times, that's the BBC's magazine, and the TV Times for the commercial channel. The name Radio Times harks back to the very early days of the BBC. These two publications were scoured by each family member, with everyone marking the movies or specials they wanted to see. It was a campaign to maximise the best Christmas viewing. A common problem arose if the family TV, that's the big one with the colour, was already booked by a family member higher in the pecking order. In that case, you had to resort to the small black and white portable. Monochrome was far better than missing the programme. In those days, the competition between the BBC and the commercial channel was fierce. All stocks were pulled out for the glitz and glamour of Christmas. The only downside was that as each page of the magazine was turned, the end of the holidays and the inevitable return to school loomed closer.
By the time this episode arrives, we'll be just about 1 week into the 2024 Christmas season. And that means there's still plenty of time for you to share a memory to appear in an upcoming episode. All you have to do is record yourself speaking into your phone's voice memo app and send it to christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Try to keep it reasonably short, clean and family-friendly, and be sure to say your name and where you're from. Christmas Past is produced in wonderful Willow Glen, California, by yours truly, Brian Earle. Thanks very much to Professor Eric Van Den Eickel. You can check the show notes to this episode for a link to his book, The Magi. By the way, that reading from the King James Version of the Gospel of Matthew comes courtesy of LibriVox Recordings, and thanks to them and the narrator, Michael Armenta. Thanks also to Carrie in Arkansas, to Graham in Scotland, and, as always, to you. Drop me a line anytime throughout this Christmas season or any time of year. I always love to hear from you, and I try to respond to every message I get. You can reach me at christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Or connect with me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And hey, join our private Christmas Past Facebook group if you haven't yet. And if you're really feeling the Christmas spirit, why not help more people discover the show? It's as simple as telling a friend about it or leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. If you do leave a review, I'll send you a Christmas Past sticker, and a handwritten Christmas card is my way of saying thanks. Reach out for details, and until we meet again, may your days be merry and bright.